Disc 12.
He did as she said. A while later, as she and Lillian were sitting together sipping their coffee, he came back and sat down next to them.
"Well, did you find out anything?" said Charlotte, trying by sheer force of will to make him say something positive.
Unfortunately, it didn't work. Nicholas's face was grim when he said,
"I'm afraid we have to prepare for the worst. They're doing what they can, but they're not sure that Stieg will live out the day. We just have to wait and see."
Lillian gasped and threw her arms around Nicholas's neck. Feeling just as awkward as Charlotte, he tried to console her by patting her back. Charlotte had a sense of déjà vu. Lillian had been in this same state when Charlotte's father died, and the doctors ended up giving her a sedative so she wouldn't totally fall apart. The whole thing was so unfair. Losing one husband was bad enough. Charlotte turned to Nicholas.
"Couldn't they tell you anything about what's wrong with him?"
"They're doing lots of tests and will probably work out eventually what it is. But right now the most important thing is to keep him alive long enough to be able to find the proper treatment. As things look now, it could be anything from cancer to some viral infection. All they said was that he should have come to the hospital long ago."
Charlotte saw the guilt flicker like a shadow across his face. She leaned her head against his shoulder.
"You're only human, Nicholas. Stieg didn't want to go to the hospital, and it didn't seem dangerous when you examined him, did it? He was up now and then and seemed fairly spry, and he said himself that he didn't have much pain."
"I should have listened to him. Damn it, I'm a doctor. I should have known better."
"Don't forget that we've had a few other things on our minds," Charlotte said in a low voice, but Lillian still heard her.
"Why does all the misfortune in the world have to descend on us? First Sora and now Stieg," she wailed, blowing her nose in the paper napkin that Charlotte had given her.
People in the waiting room, who had gone back to reading their magazines, now looked at them again. Charlotte felt irritation seize hold of her.
"You have to pull yourself together. The doctors are doing all they can," she said, trying to make her voice as soothing as possible, without taking the force out of what she said.
Lillian gave her an injured look, but obeyed and stopped sniffling. Charlotte sighed and rolled her eyes at Nicholas. She didn't doubt that her mother's distress about Stieg was genuine, but her tendency to turn every situation into a drama, starring herself, was incredibly trying. Lillian had always thrived when she was the centre of attention, and she used every means at her disposal to achieve that position, even in a situation like this. That was just how she was, and Charlotte struggled to accept it and conceal her vexation. This time, her mother's suffering was real. 6 hours later, they still hadn't got any news. Nicholas had gone in to talk with the doctors repeatedly, but they didn't have any more information. The prognosis for Stieg was still uncertain.
"Somebody has to drive home and see to Albin," said Charlotte, talking as much to Lillian as to Nicholas.
She saw that her mother opened her mouth to protest, unwilling to let either her daughter or son-in-law go. But Nicholas anticipated what she was going to say.
"Yes, you're right. He'll be terrified if Veronica tries to put him to bed at her house. I'll go, so you can stay here."
Lillian looked annoyed, but she knew that they were right, and reluctantly gave in. Nicholas kissed Charlotte on the cheek, and then patted Lillian on the shoulder.
"Everything will work out. You'll see. Ring if you hear anything."
Charlotte nodded. She watched him vanish down the corridor and then leaned back in the uncomfortable chair and closed her eyes. It was going to be a long wait.
Göteborg, 1958.
The disappointment ate at Mary from the inside. Nothing had turned out the way she'd thought. Nothing had changed, except that now she didn't even receive the brief displays of kindness and tenderness her mother had given her when Orca was around. In fact, Mary hardly ever saw her. She was either on her way out to meet Per Erik, or she had to go to a party somewhere. Her mother also seemed to have abandoned all attempts to control Mary's weight, so she could eat anything in the house. By now, she had far surpassed her former top weight. Sometimes, when she looked at herself in the mirror, she saw only the monster that had been growing inside her for so long. A voracious, fat, loathsome monster, constantly surrounded by a nauseating smell of sweat. Mother didn't even bother to conceal the disgust she felt when she looked at her. Once, she had even demonstratively held her nose when she passed by. The humiliation still stung. This wasn't the way that Mother had promised things would be. Per Erik was supposed to be a much better father than Orca ever was. Mother would be happy, and they would finally live together like a real family. The monster would disappear. She would never again have to sit in the cellar, and that dry, sickening, dusty smell would never again fill her mouth. Duped. That was how she felt. Duped. She'd tried to ask her mother when things were going to be as she'd promised, but she'd only got brusque answers in return. When she insisted, she'd been locked in the cellar, after first being fed a little humility. She had cried bitter tears that contained far more disappointment than she could handle. Sitting in the dark, she felt the monster thriving. It liked the dryness in her mouth. It ate it and rejoiced. The door closed heavily behind him. Moving slowly, Patrick went into the hall and wriggled out of his jacket. He left it lying on the floor, too exhausted to bother hanging it up. "What happened?" said Erika in a worried voice from the living room. "Did you find out something new?" When he saw her face, Patrick felt a pang of guilt that he hadn't stayed at home with her and Maya. He must look like a wreck. He had rung home from time to time, of course, but the chaos at the station, after what happened, had made the conversations extremely abrupt and stressful. As soon as he confirmed that everything was all right at home, he had more or less hung up on her. He plodded into the living room. As usual, Erika was sitting in the dark and watching TV with Maya on her lap.
"I'm sorry I was so curt on the phone," he said, rubbing his face wearily.
"Did something happen?" He collapsed onto the sofa and at first couldn't reply.
"Yeah," he said after a moment. "Ernst got the idea of bringing in Morgan Wieberger for questioning, completely on his own authority. He managed to stress the poor boy out so badly that he escaped out of a window, ran into the street and was run over."
"My God, that's horrible," said Erika. "What happened to him?"
"He died." Erika gasped. Maya, who was asleep, whimpered, but then settled down again. "It was so horrendous. You wouldn't even believe it," said Patrick, leaning his head back and staring up at the ceiling. As he lay there in the street, Monica arrived and caught sight of him. She rushed forward before we could stop her, took his head in her lap, and then sat rocking him and wailing in a way that hardly sounded human. We finally had to tear her away from him. Jesus Christ, it was ghastly.
"And Ernst?" said Erika. "What happened to him?"
"For the first time, I actually think he's going to be sacked. I've never seen Melberrier so mad. He sent him home on the spot, and after this I don't think he'll be coming back, which would be a blessing."
"Does Kai know?"
"Yeah, and that's a whole other story. Martin and I were questioning him when the accident happened, and we had to run outside. If it had happened a few minutes later, I think we could have got him to talk. Now he's totally clammed up and refuses to say a word. He blames us for Morgan's death, and to some degree he's right. Some colleagues from Uteboria were supposed to arrive this morning to interrogate Kai, but they had to postpone it indefinitely. Kai's lawyer put a stop to all questioning for the time being, considering the circumstances."
"So, you still don't know whether he was involved in Sora's murder? And in... well, in what happened yesterday?"
"No," said Patrick wearily. "The only thing that's sure is that it couldn't have been Kai who took Maya out of the pram. We had him in custody at the time. Has Dan been here, by the way?" he said, caressing his daughter and lifting her over to his lap.
"Yes, he was. He's been like a faithful watchdog." Erika smiled, but it didn't reach all the way to her eyes.
I finally had to send him away, more or less. He left half an hour ago. I wouldn't be surprised if he spends the night in our garden in a sleeping bag. Patrick laughed.
Yeah, that sounds plausible. At any rate, I owe him one. It feels good to know that you two weren't alone here today.
You know, we were just on our way upstairs to go to bed, Maya and I. But we can sit up a while longer if you'd like some company.
Don't be offended, but I'd prefer to sit by myself for a while, Patrick replied. I brought home some work to do, and then maybe I'll watch TV to wind down for a while.
Do whatever you feel like doing, said Erika.
She got up and took Maya from Patrick after giving him a kiss on the mouth.
By the way,
how was your day? He asked when she was halfway up the stairs.
Fine, said Erika, and Patrick could hear that there was new energy in her voice. Today she didn't need to sleep at my breast at all. She slept in the pram, and now she doesn't cry for more than 20 minutes. In fact, last time it was actually only 5.
Good, he said. It sounds like you're starting to get control of the situation.
Yeah. What a miracle that it actually works, she said with a laugh.
Then she turned serious. Although Maya can only sleep indoors now, I don't dare put her outside ever again. I'm sorry. I was so dumb last night, said Patrick hesitantly. He didn't want to risk saying anything stupid again, which left him fumbling for every word, even to apologise.
That's okay, she said. I've been a little oversensitive too, but I think the tide has turned now.
The fright I got when she was missing had at least one beneficial effect. It made me realise how thankful I am for every minute with her.
Yeah, I know what you mean, he said with a wave as she continued upstairs.
He shut off the sound on the TV, took out his cassette player and pressed rewind and then play. He had already listened to the tape several times at the station. It was the few minutes that were recorded of Ernst's so-called interrogation of Morgan. Not much was said, but there was still something that bothered him, something he couldn't quite put his finger on. After listening to the tape 3 times, he gave up, put away the cassette player and went to the kitchen. He pottered about for a couple of minutes and emerged with a cup of hot chocolate and 3 cheese and caviar sandwiches on delicious Skogaholm bread. He turned up the sound on the TV and switched to Crime Night on the Discovery Channel. Watching reenactments of real crimes was perhaps an odd way for a cop to relax, but he always found it soothing. The crimes were always solved. As he watched the programme, a thought of a highly private nature began to take shape. A highly pleasurable and invigorating idea which effectively repressed all images of crime and death. Patrick smiled as he sat there in the dark. He would have to go on a little shopping expedition. The light was piercing and relentless in the cell. Kai felt that it was penetrating every part of him, every nook and cranny. He tried to hide from it by burying his head in his arms, but he still felt the light prickling the back of his neck. In only a few days, his whole world had come crashing down. It might seem naive in hindsight, but he had felt so safe, so untouchable. He had been part of a group that seemed above the ordinary world. They weren't like the others. They were better, more enlightened than everyone else. What the world didn't understand was that it was all about love. Nothing but love. Sex was only a small part of the whole. Sensuality was the closest word he could find to describe it. Young skin was so pure, so unsullied. Children's minds were full of innocence, not befouled by ugly thoughts as the minds of adults were, sooner or later. What they were doing was helping these young people to develop so that they could reach their full potential. They helped them to understand what love was. Sex was the tool, but not the goal in itself. The goal was to achieve an accord, a union of souls, an association between young and old, so beautiful in its purity. But no one would understand. They had talked about it so much in the chat rooms.
how the stupidity of others and the narrow-mindedness of their thinking made them unable to imagine, even trying to understand what was so obvious to the members of the group. Instead, the others were so eager to label what they were doing as dirty. They even then labelled the children in the same way. Against that background, he could understand why Sebastian did what he did. The boy had realised that nobody would understand, that he would be forever after regarded with abhorrence and contempt. But what Kai couldn't understand was why he'd levelled such accusations against him in his final farewell to the world. Kai felt hurt. He had really believed that they'd reached a deep mutual understanding during their meetings, and that Sebastian's soul, after the initial reluctance that always had to be overcome, had willingly sought to merge with Kai's. He had regarded the physical act as something subordinate. It was the feeling of literally drinking from the fountain of youth that had been the real reward. Had Sebastian really not understood that? Had he been pretending the whole time, or was it society's norms that had made him disavow their affinity in his last letter? It pained Kai to think that he would never know. He had tried not to dwell on the other matter. Ever since they had brought him the news of Morgan's death, he had tried to push away all thought of his son. It was as if his brain couldn't accept the cruel truth, but the merciless light in his cell forced images upon him that he fought hard to keep at bay. And yet one thought had spitefully caught up with him, the idea that this was perhaps his punishment. But he hastened to fend it off. He hadn't done anything wrong. Over the years, he had come to love other boys, and they had loved him. That's how it was, and that's how it had to be. The alternative was too terrible for him even to imagine. It must have been love. He knew that he had never been much of a father to Morgan. It had been so difficult. Even in the beginning, his son had been hard to love. And he had often admired Monica because she was able to show him affection, that intractable, awkward child of theirs. Another thought occurred to him. Maybe they were going to try and make a case that he'd touched Morgan. The very idea made him furious. Morgan was his son, after all, his own flesh and blood. He knew that was what they'd say, but it was only proof of how restricted and narrow-minded they were. It wasn't the same thing at all. The love between father and son was different from the love between him and the others. It was on a completely different level. And yet he had loved Morgan. He knew that Monica didn't believe it, but it was true. He simply hadn't known how to reach out to Morgan. All his attempts had been rejected, and he sometimes wondered if Monica, in some subtle way, might have been thwarting them. She had wanted him all to herself, wanted to be the only parent he turned to. Kai was effectively shut out, and even though she rebuked him and accused him of not engaging with his son, he knew that secretly that was precisely the way she wanted it. And now it was too late to change anything. As the harsh light of the fluorescent tube flickered at him, he lay on his side on the floor and curled up in the fetal position. So far, the medical examiners on TV had solved 3 cases in 45 minutes. They made it seem easy, but Patrick was well aware that it wasn't that simple. He hoped that Pedersen would get back to him tomorrow with news about the ashes on Liam's shirt and Maya's overalls. Then a new case was presented. Patrick watched the programme listlessly and felt sleep sneaking over him as he reclined on the sofa. But slowly the details of the case began to sink into his consciousness. He sat up and focused his attention on the TV screen. It was a case from the States from many years ago, but the circumstances seemed eerily familiar. He hurried to press the record button on the VCR, hoping he wasn't recording over the last episode of one of Erika's reality shows. If so, the family jewels would be at risk. It was in such situations that his dear life partner usually threatened to get out a rusty pair of scissors. The ME in charge of the analyses spoke at great length and in detail. He showed diagrams and photos to explain the course of events as clearly as possible, and Patrick had no difficulty following along.
An idea began to shape in his mind, and he nervously checked again to see that the record symbol was visible on the VCR's display. He was going to have to watch the show a couple of more times. After playing the segment three more times, he felt as certain as he could be. But he still needed to get a little help with his memory. Excited and well aware of the urgent nature of his quest, he went upstairs to find Erika in the bedroom. She had Maya next to her, so he assumed that their daughter was getting a little reward for sleeping so well in the pram during the day.
"Erika," he whispered,
and shook her shoulder gently. He was terrified of waking Maya, but he had to talk to Erika. Was the only reply, and she made no attempt to move.
"Erika, you have to wake up."
This time he got a response. She gave a start, looked around in confusion, and said,
"What? What is it? Is Maya awake? Is she crying? I'd better fetch her."
Erika sat up and was about to get out of bed.
"No, no,"
said Patrick, carefully pushing her back down on the bed.
"Shh! Maya is sleeping like a log."
He pointed at the little bundle that now squirmed a bit.
"So, why are you waking me up?" said Erika morosely. "If you wake Maya, I'll murder you."
"Because I have to ask you something, and it can't wait."
He quickly told her what he'd just learned, and then asked the question weighing on his mind. After a moment of astonished silence, she gave him his answer. He told her to go back to sleep, kissed her on the cheek, and hurried back downstairs. With a grim expression on his face, he punched in a number that he looked up in the phone book. Every minute counted. Göteborg, 1958. Something was wrong. She had let it go on for far too long. A year and a half had passed since Åke died, and Per Erik had met her demands for action with excuses that kept getting vaguer and vaguer. Recently, he had scarcely bothered to answer her at all, and the phone calls summoning her to the Hotel Eggers were now few and far between. She had begun to hate that place. The soft hotel sheets against her skin and the impersonal furniture now filled her with a nauseating revulsion.
She wanted something else. She deserved something better. She deserved to move into his big villa, to be allowed to be the hostess at his parties, to be given respect, status, and mention in the society columns. Who did he think she was, anyway?
Agnes trembled with rage as she sat behind the steering wheel. Through the windscreen, she saw Per Erik's big white brick villa, and behind the curtains she glimpsed a shadow moving through the rooms. His Volvo wasn't parked on the drive. It was Tuesday morning, so he was no doubt at work, and Elizabeth was at home alone, probably devoting herself to being the excellent little housewife she was, hemming tablecloths or polishing the silver or doing some other boring task that Agnes would never stoop to do. Surely Elizabeth had no idea that her life was about to be smashed to bits. Agnes felt not the slightest hesitation. The thought didn't even occur to her that Per Erik's ever more evasive manner might be due to a fading enthusiasm for her. No, it must be Elizabeth's fault that he still hadn't come to her as a free man. She pretended to be so helpless, so pitiful and dependent, just to bind him to her. But Agnes saw through that act, even though Per Erik did not. And if he wasn't man enough to confront his wife, Agnes had no such scruples. She got out of the car with determined steps, wrapped her fur coat tighter in the November chill, and walked quickly up the path to the front door. Elizabeth opened it after only two rings and broke into a smile that made Agnes writhe with contempt. She longed to wipe that smile off her face.
"Well, if it isn't Agnes, how lovely of you to come and visit."
Agnes saw that Elizabeth meant what she said, while at the same time she had a slightly puzzled look. Of course, Agnes had been a guest in their home before, but only at dinner parties and celebrations. She had never before dropped by unannounced.
"Come in," said Elizabeth. "You'll have to excuse the mess. If I'd known you were coming, I would have picked up."
Agnes stepped into the hall and looked around for the mess that Elizabeth mentioned. All she could see was that everything was in its proper place, which confirmed her image of Elizabeth as the ultimate pathetic homemaker.
"Have a seat, and I'll fetch some coffee," said Elizabeth politely.
And before Agnes could stop her, she was on her way to the kitchen. Agnes hadn't intended to have a coffee clutch with Père Eric's wife. She had planned to get what she'd come for and leave as quickly as possible. But she reluctantly hung up her fur coat and sat down on the sofa in the living room. No sooner had she sat down than Elizabeth appeared with a tray holding cups and thick slices of sponge cake. She set the tray on the dark, highly polished coffee table. The coffee must have been already brewed because she hadn't been gone more than a couple of minutes. Elizabeth sat down in the easy chair next to the sofa.
"Please, have some sponge cake. I baked it today."
Agnes looked with distaste at the cake saturated with butter and sugar and said,
"I'll just have coffee, thank you."
She reached for one of the two porcelain cups on the tray. She sipped the coffee, which was strong and good.
"Yes, I can see that you still watch your figure," Elizabeth said with a laugh, taking a slice of sponge cake.
"I lost that battle after I had kids," she said, nodding towards a photo of their three children, who were now all grown up. Agnes pondered for a moment how they would take the news of their parents' divorce and their new stepmother, but felt assured that with a little effort she'd be able to win them over to her side. In time, they would probably see how much more she had to offer Père Eric than Elizabeth did. She watched the cake vanish into Elizabeth's mouth, and her hostess reached for another slice. The unbridled craving for sweets reminded Agnes of her daughter, and she had to stop herself from leaning over and tearing the sponge cake out of Elizabeth's hand, the same way she used to do with the girl. Instead, she smiled courteously and said,
"I realise that you must think it's a bit odd for me to show up like this unannounced, but unfortunately I have something unpleasant to tell you."
"Something unpleasant? What on earth could that be?" said Elizabeth, in a tone that should have alerted Agnes if she hadn't been so intent on what she was about to do.
"Well, it's like this, you see," said Agnes, carefully setting down her coffee cup. "Père Eric and I have come to, we've developed a great fondness for each other, and we've felt this way for quite a long while."
"And now you want to build a life together," Elizabeth filled in. Agnes was relieved that the whole thing was going more smoothly than she thought. Then she looked at Elizabeth and realised that something was wrong. Something was terribly wrong. Père Eric's wife was regarding her with a sardonic smile, and her gaze had a coldness to it that Agnes had never seen in her before.
"I understand that this may come as a shock," Agnes began, now unsure whether her carefully prepared speech would still hold.
"My dear Agnes, I've known about your little relationship since it started. We have an understanding, Père Eric and I, and it works admirably for both of us. Surely you didn't think you were the first, did you?"
"Or the last," said Elizabeth, in a nasty tone of voice that made Agnes want to raise her hand and give her a slap.
"I don't know what you're talking about," said Agnes in desperation, feeling the floor giving way beneath her feet.
"Don't tell me you hadn't noticed that Père Eric was beginning to lose interest. He doesn't ring you as often. You have a hard time getting hold of him. He seems distracted when you meet." "Oh, yes, I know my husband well enough after 40 years of marriage to know how he would act in such a situation. And I also know that the new object of his desire is a 30-year-old brunette who works as a secretary at his firm."
"You're lying," said Agnes, seeing Elizabeth's plump features as if in a fog.
"You can believe what you like. Just ask Père Eric yourself.
Now I think you should go." Elizabeth got up, went out to the hall, and demonstratively held up Agnes's shimmering grey fur coat. Still incapable of taking in what Elizabeth had said, Agnes mutely followed her hostess. In shock, she then stood on the front steps and let the wind shove her gently from side to side, feeling the familiar rage rising up inside her. It was even stronger, because she felt that she should have known better. she shouldn't have thought that she could trust a man. Now she was being punished by being betrayed once again.
As if wading through water, she headed for the car she had parked a bit down the street and then sat motionless in the driver's seat for a long time. Her thoughts scurried back and forth in her head like ants, digging deep tunnels of hatred and a desire for revenge. All the events of the past that she had long ago stuffed in the far reaches of her memory now came seeping out. Her knuckles holding the wheel turned white. She leaned her head against the headrest and closed her eyes. Images of the horrible years in the stonecutter's house came to her, and she could smell the muck and sweat from the men who came home after a day's work. She remembered the pains that made her slip in and out of consciousness when the boys were born. The smell of smoke when the houses in Fjällbacka burned, the breeze on the ship to New York, the hum of the crowd and the sound of popping champagne corks, the moans of pleasure from the nameless men who had lain with her, Mary's weeping when she was abandoned on the dock, the sound of Okus's breathing as it slowly flagged and then stopped, Père Eric's voice when he made her one promise after another, the promises he never intended to keep. All that and more flickered past behind her closed eyelids, and nothing she saw quelled her fury, which was rising to a crescendo. She had done everything to gain the life she deserved, recreate the luxury to which she was born. But life, or fate, had kept tripping her up. Everyone had been against her and done his best to take from her what was rightfully hers. First her father, then Anders, the American suitors, Orca, and now Père Eric. A long series of men whose common denominator was that in various ways they had all exploited and betrayed her. As twilight fell, all these actual and imagined offences coalesced into a single burning point in Agnes's brain. With an empty gaze, she stared at Père Eric's driveway, and slowly a great calm descended over her as she sat in the car. Once before in her life, she had felt the same sense of calm, and she knew that it came from the certainty that now there was only one course of action left. By the time the headlights of his car finally cut through the darkness, Agnes had been sitting stock still for nearly 3 hours, but she was unaware of the time that had passed. Time no longer had any relevance. All her senses were focused on the task that lay before her, and there was not a shred of doubt in her mind. All logic, all knowledge of consequences had been eradicated in favour of instinct and a desire to act. With eyes narrowed, she saw him park the car, take his briefcase, which always lay beside him on the passenger seat, and step out. As he conscientiously locked the car, she cautiously started her engine and put the car in gear. Then everything happened very fast. She stomped the gas pedal to the floor, and the car rushed towards its unsuspecting target. She cut across a patch of lawn, and not until the car was only a few metres away did Père Eric sense that something was happening and turn round. For a fraction of a second their eyes met, and then he was struck directly in the midriff and slammed into the side of his own car. With his arms outstretched, he lay collapsed over the bonnet of her car. She saw his eyelids flutter and then slowly close. Behind the wheel, Agnes was smiling. No one betrayed her and got away with it. Anna awoke with the same feeling of hopelessness she felt every morning. She couldn't remember the last time she'd slept through an entire night. Instead, she devoted the dark hours to pondering how she and the kids could escape this situation she had put them in. Lucas was sleeping calmly next to her. Sometimes he would turn in his sleep and put his arm over her, and she had to grit her teeth not to jump out of bed in disgust. It wasn't worth what would follow. The past few days, everything had seemed to accelerate. His outbursts came more frequently, and she felt as if together they were stuck in a spiral that was spinning ever faster, sending them into the abyss. Only one of them would return from those depths. Which of them it would be, she didn't know. But both of them couldn't exist at the same time. She had read somewhere about a theory
claiming there was a parallel universe with a parallel twin of every living organism. And if you ever met your twin, both of you would be instantly annihilated. That was how it was with her and Lucas, but their destruction was slower and more excruciating. They hadn't been out of the flat in several days now. When she heard Adrian's voice from the mattress in the corner, she got up cautiously to go and fetch him. It wouldn't do to wake Lucas. Together they went out to the kitchen and began to make breakfast. Lucas was eating almost nothing these days, and had grown so thin that his clothes hung loose on his body. But he still demanded to have 3 meals a day set on the table at specified times. Adrian whined and refused to sit in his high chair. She desperately shushed him, but he was in a rotten mood because he slept poorly at night. He seemed to be plagued by nightmares. Now he got louder and louder, and nothing Anna did seemed to help. With a sinking feeling in her chest, she heard Lucas stirring in the bedroom, and at the same moment Emma began to shout. Anna's instinct told her to flee, but she knew that it was hopeless. All she could do was steel herself, and in the best case, try to protect the children.
"What the fuck is going on here?"
Lucas yelled in English. He loomed in the doorway, and the eerie look in his eye was there again. It was an empty, insane and cold look, and she knew that it would eventually spell their doom.
"Can't you get your children to shut the fuck up?"
Now his tone was no longer loud and threatening, but almost gentle. This was the tone she feared most.
"I'm doing the best I can," she replied in Swedish, and she heard how squeaky her voice sounded.
Sitting in his high chair, Adrian had now worked himself up to a fit of hysteria. He shrieked and banged on the table with his spoon.
"No eat! No eat!"
he repeated over and over. Frantically, Anna tried again to shush him, but he was so wound up he couldn't stop.
"You don't have to eat. You're excused. You don't have to,"
she said soothingly, and began to lift him down from the chair.
"He's gonna eat the bloody food,"
said Lucas, his voice still calm. Anna felt herself freeze. Adrian was now struggling wildly because she wouldn't put him down as promised, but instead was trying to force him back into the high chair.
"No eat! No eat!"
he screamed at the top of his lungs, and it took all Anna's strength to keep him in the chair. With cold resolve, Lucas took one of the bread slices Anna had put out on the table. He put one hand on Adrian's head and held it in an iron grip, and with the other he began to force the bread into his mouth. The little boy began to thrash with his arms, first in anger and then with rising panic, as the big hunk of bread filled his mouth, making it harder and harder to breathe. Anna stood almost paralysed at first. Then all her maternal instincts were aroused, and her fear of Lucas completely vanished. The only thought in her head was that her children were in need of protection, and adrenaline spurted into her bloodstream. With a primitive snarl, she tore Lucas's hand away and quickly picked the bread out of Adrian's mouth, who now had tears coursing down his cheeks. Then she turned round to confront Lucas. Faster and faster the vortex was whirling them into the abyss. Melberje, too, awoke feeling uneasy, but for much more selfish reasons. During the night, he'd been jolted awake several times from a sweaty dream, and the scene was always the same. He was being given the boot under unceremonious circumstances. It simply mustn't happen. There had to be some way for him to evade responsibility for yesterday's unfortunate event. The first step was to fire Ernst. This time, there was no alternative. Melberje was aware that earlier he might have been a trifle too indulgent with Lundgren, but to some extent he had felt that they were kindred souls. He at least had considerably more in common with him than with the other namby-pambies at the station. But unlike Melberje, Ernst had now exhibited a devastating lack of judgment, and it had quite rightly been his undoing. It was a cardinal error. He really thought that Lundgren would have known better. He sighed and swung his legs over the edge of the bed. He always slept in only his underpants, and now he reached down to his crotch under his big paunch to scratch himself and rearrange his equipment. Melberia looked at the clock. A few minutes to nine. Almost too late to show up at work, but they hadn't got out of there before eight last night, since they'd had to go over in detail everything that had happened. He'd already begun to polish up his report to his superiors. The important thing was for him to keep the facts straight and not make any blunders. Damage control was the name of the game. He went to the living room and stood for a moment admiring Simon. He was lying on his back on the sofa, snoring with his mouth open and one leg dangling to the floor. The covers had fallen off, and Melberia couldn't help reflecting that he had passed on his physique to his son. Simon was no skinny little wimp, but a powerfully built young man who would surely follow in his father's footsteps if he just pulled himself together. He poked at him with his toe. "Hey, Simon, time to wake up." The boy ignored him and turned over on his side with his face to the back of the sofa. Melberia mercilessly kept poking him. Naturally, he also appreciated a chance to sleep in, but this wasn't supposed to be some holiday camp. "Do you hear me?" "Get up," I said. Still no reaction, and Melberia sighed. Well, he'd have to bring up the heavy artillery. He went out to the kitchen, let the water run in the tap until it was ice cold, filled a pitcher full of water, and then walked calmly into the living room. With a cheerful smile on his lips, he poured the ice-cold water over his son's uncovered body and got precisely the effect he wanted. "What the fuck?" yelled Simon, and was off the sofa in a flash. He shivered and grabbed a towel from the floor to dry himself off. "What the bloody hell do you think you're doing?" he said sullenly, and pulled on a T-shirt with a skull on it and the name of a heavy metal band. "Breakfast is served in 5 minutes," said Melberia, as he went out to the kitchen whistling. For a brief moment, he had forgotten his career-related worries and was instead extremely pleased with the plan he'd worked out for their future father and son activities. Lacking pawn clubs and casinos, they would have to take what there was. And in Tornumshader, that meant the Petroglyph Museum. Not because he was particularly interested in doodles carved on stone slabs, but it was at least something that they could do together. Because he had decided that would be the new theme of their relationship, togetherness. No more playing video games hour after hour, no more TV watching until late in the evening, since it effectively killed all communication. Instead, they would have dinner together, with fruitful discussions, and afterwards possibly a game of Monopoly to round out the evening. He enthusiastically presented his plans to Simon over breakfast, but had to admit that he was a bit disappointed at the boy's reaction. Here he was, taking great pains to do everything so that they could get to know each other. He was renouncing the activities he personally enjoyed and sacrificing himself by going to the museum with the boy. Simon's response was to sit there staring morosely into his bowl of Rice Krispies. Spoiled, that's what he was. His mother had sent him to his father in the nick of time. The boy clearly needed discipline and guidance. Melberia sighed as he headed off to work. Being a parent was a heavy responsibility. Patrick was at work by 8 o'clock. He too had slept poorly, more or less simply waiting for it to be morning, so he could get going on what had to be done. The first thing was to check whether last night's conversation had made any difference. His finger trembled a little as he dialed the number that he now knew by heart. "Uddevalla Hospital." He gave the name of the doctor he wanted to speak with and waited impatiently as he was paged. After what seemed like an eternity, the call was put through.
"Yes. Hello. This is Patrick Hedström. We spoke last night. I wonder whether my information has been of any use."
He listened tensely, and then made a gesture of victory with his clenched fist. Yes, he'd been right. After he rung up, he began whistling as he considered the consequences now that his hunch had proved to be right. They would have a lot to do today. His second call was to the prosecutor. He had rung him with an identical request less than a year ago, and since what he had asked was so unusual, he hoped that the prosecutor wouldn't have a fit.
"Yes, you heard correctly. I need to get permission for an exhumation."
Again, Yes. No, not the same grave. We've already opened that one, haven't we? He spoke slowly and clearly and tried not to sound impatient. Yes, it's urgent this time as well, and I'd be grateful if the request could be processed immediately. All the required documents are on the way by fax. You've probably received them already, and the documents refer to two requests, both the exhumation order and another search warrant. The prosecutor still seemed dubious, and Patrick felt irritation creeping over him. With a hint of sharpness in his voice, he said, "We're investigating the homicide of a child, and another person's life may be at risk. This is not a request that I make lightly. I'm doing so after careful consideration, and only because the continued progress of the investigation requires it. So, I'm counting on your office to pull out all the stops to process this as fast as humanly possible. I would like a reply before lunch, regarding both matters." Then he hung up and hoped that his little outburst wouldn't have the opposite effect and put the brakes on the whole thing. But that was the chance he had to take. With the worst task behind him, he made a third call. Pedersen sounded tired when he answered. "Hello, Hedström," he said. "Good morning, good morning. Sounds like you had to work late last night." "Yes, things really piled up here in the wee hours, but we're about to see the end of it. Just some paperwork left, and then I'm out of here."
"Sounds like a rough night," said Patrick, and felt a little guilty because he'd rung the ME to nag him after what had obviously been a really tough shift.
"I assume you want the test results from the ashes on the shirt and overalls. I actually got them in late yesterday afternoon, but then things got crazy here."
He gave an exhausted sigh.
"Did I hear right that the overalls belonged to your daughter?"
"Yes, that's right," said Patrick. "We had a nasty incident at home the other day, but thank goodness she wasn't hurt."
"Well, that's good to hear," said Pedersen. "I can understand why you're on pins and needles waiting for the result."
"I won't deny it. But I actually didn't think that you'd have the results back already, so what did you find out?"
Pedersen cleared his throat. "Let's see. Yes, there doesn't seem to be any doubt. The composition of the ashes is identical with those we found in the girl's lungs."
Patrick exhaled and then realized how tense he had been. "So, that's it then?"
"That's it," said Pedersen.
"Were you able to confirm the origin of the ashes? Are they from an animal or a human being?"
"Unfortunately, we're not able to determine that. The remains have decayed too much and the ashes too fine. With a bigger sample, we might be able to trace it, but..."
"I'll wait for the news from a house search we're doing. Looking for the ashes is at the top of our list. If we find them, I'll send some over at once for analysis." "Maybe you can find some larger particles," Patrick said hopefully.
"Sure, but don't count on it," said Pedersen.
"I don't count on anything any longer, but I can always hope." With the formalities taken care of, Patrick drummed his feet impatiently on the floor. Before the decision arrived from the prosecutor, there wasn't much of a practical nature he could accomplish. But he knew that he wouldn't be able to sit in his office for a couple of hours twiddling his thumbs. He'd heard the others show up at work one by one, so he decided to call a meeting. They all had to be brought up to date, and he realized that more than one of his colleagues would probably raise an eyebrow at what he had set in motion last night and this morning. He was right. He got a lot of questions. Patrick replied as best he could, but there was still so much he couldn't explain. Way too much. Charlotte rubbed the sleep out of her eyes. She and Lillian had each been given a bed in a little room near the intensive care unit, but neither of them got much sleep. Since Charlotte hadn't brought anything with her from home, she'd slept in her clothes, and she felt incredibly rumpled and grubby when she sat up and began to stretch. "Oh, have you got a comb?" she asked her mother, who had also sat up. "Yes, I think so," said Lillian, digging in her worn handbag. She found one in the very bottom and handed it to Charlotte. In the bathroom, Charlotte stood in front of the mirror and studied herself critically. The light was mercilessly bright, clearly showing the dark circles under her eyes, and her hair stood on end in an odd, psychedelic hairdo. She carefully combed out the tangles until her hair had more or less regained her normal style.
At the same time, everything to do with her appearance seemed so meaningless now. Sora kept hovering in the periphery of her vision, holding her heart in an iron grip. Her stomach growled, but before she went down to the cafeteria, she wanted to get hold of a doctor who could tell her how Stierg was doing. Every time she heard footsteps outside the door during the night, she had woken up, prepared to see a doctor come in with a serious expression on his face. No one had disturbed them, so she assumed that no news was good news in this case. But she still wanted to hear something, so she went out in the corridor, wondering which way to go. A nurse who passed by showed her the way to the staff lounge. She pondered whether she should turn on her mobile and ring home to Nicholas first, but decided to wait until after she'd talked to the doctor. He and Albin were probably still asleep, and she didn't want to risk waking them too early. Then Albin would be in a grumpy mood for the rest of the day. She stuck her head in the doorway that the nurse pointed out and cleared her throat quietly. A tall man sat drinking coffee and leafing through a magazine. From what Nicholas had said, it was unusual for a doctor to be able to sit down, even for a moment, and she felt almost embarrassed at bothering him. Then Charlotte reminded herself why she was here and cleared her throat a little louder. This time he heard her and turned with an inquiring glance.
Yes?
Excuse me, but my stepfather, Stig Florin, was admitted yesterday, and we haven't heard anything since late last night. Do you know how he's doing? Was she imagining things, or did the doctor get a strange look on his face? If so, it vanished as quickly as it had appeared.
Stig Florin.
Oh, yes, we stabilised his vital signs during the night, and he's awake now.
He is, said Charlotte, beaming with joy. Could we go in and see him? My mother's here too.
Once again, that strange expression. Charlotte was starting to get uneasy despite the good news. Was there something he wasn't telling her? The reply came hesitantly. I don't think it's a very good idea just yet. He's still weak and needs to rest.
Yes, but you could let my mother in for a moment, couldn't you? It couldn't hurt. It might even help. They're very close.
I can imagine, said the doctor. But I'm afraid you'll have to wait. Right now, nobody is being let in to see Mr. Florin.
But why?
You'll just have to wait, the doctor said brusquely, and she began to get really annoyed with him. Didn't they have to undergo some sort of training in medical school about how to handle relatives? He was on the verge of being rude. He could thank his lucky stars that she was the one who had come to talk to him and not Lillian. If he'd treated her mother like this, he would have got such a talking to that his ears would have fallen off. Charlotte knew that she herself was altogether too compliant in these types of situations, so she merely muttered something and then retreated to the corridor. She thought about what she was going to say to her mother. Something had felt very odd. Things weren't as they should be, but she couldn't for the life of her understand what was wrong. Maybe Nicholas could explain. She decided to take the risk and wake them up at home. She dialed the number on her mobile. Hopefully, he'd be able to reassure her. She already sensed that she was probably imagining things.
After the meeting, Patrick got into his car and drove to Uddevalla. It had felt impossible just to sit and wait. He had to do something. The whole way there, he kept turning over his options in his mind. They were all equally unpleasant. He'd been given directions to the ICU, but still got lost a couple of times before he found it. Why should it be so damned hard to find his way in a hospital? It must have to do with his unusually lousy sense of direction. Erika was the navigator in the family. Sometimes he thought she had some kind of sixth sense for steering them in the right direction. He stopped a nurse.
I'm looking for Rolf Wiesel. Where can I find him?
She pointed down the corridor. A tall man in a white coat was walking away from him, and he called out.
Dr. Wiesel?
The man turned round.
Yes?
Patrick hurried up to him and held out his hand.
Patrick Hedström, Tanumscheder Police. We spoke last night.
Ah, yes, said the doctor, pumping Patrick's hand. You rang in the nick of time, I have to say. We wouldn't have had any idea what sort of treatment to use otherwise, and without the right treatment, we probably would have lost him.
"I'm so glad I could help," said Patrick, feeling embarrassed by the man's enthusiasm, but a little proud, too. It wasn't every day he saved somebody's life. "Come with me," said Dr. Wiesel, gesturing towards a door that led to the staff lounge. The doctor went first, and Patrick followed. "Would you like some coffee?"
"Yes, please," said Patrick, realizing that he'd forgotten to get a cup at the station.
There had been so many thoughts buzzing around in his head that he'd even missed such a crucial part of his morning routine. They sat down at the sticky kitchen table and sipped their coffee, which tasted almost as bad as the coffee at the station.
"Sorry, I think it's been sitting in the pot too long," said Dr. Wiesel.
But Patrick raised his hand as a sign that it didn't matter.
"So, how did you reach the conclusion that our patient had arsenic poisoning?"
the doctor asked with curiosity. Patrick told him how he had been watching a program on the Discovery Channel and then put it together with certain information he'd received earlier.
"Well, it's not the most common toxin, which is why we had a hard time identifying it," said Dr. Wiesel, shaking his head.
"How does the prognosis look now?"
"He'll survive, but he'll suffer the after effects for the rest of his life. He's probably been ingesting arsenic for a long time, and it seems as though the last dose he got was massive. But we'll be able to determine that later."
"By analysing his hair and nails," said Patrick, who had gleaned that much from the programme last night.
"Yes, precisely. Arsenic remains in the body, in the hair and nails. By analysing the quantity and comparing it with the speed at which hair and nails grow, we can see almost exactly when he received the doses of arsenic and even how big they were."
"And you've seen to it that he has no visitors?"
"Yes, we did that last night when we confirmed that it was indeed arsenic poisoning. No visitors are allowed at all except the relevant medical personnel. His stepdaughter was just here and asked after him. I told her only that his condition was stable and that they couldn't see him yet."
"Good," said Patrick.
"Do you know who did it?"
the doctor asked cautiously. Patrick thought for a moment before he replied. "We have our suspicions. Hopefully we'll have them confirmed today."
"I hope so. Anyone capable of something like this shouldn't be on the loose. Arsenic poisoning causes particularly painful symptoms before the onset of death. The victim goes through terrible suffering."
"So I understand," said Patrick grimly. "I hear there's a disease that can be mistaken for arsenic poisoning." The doctor nodded.
"Guillain-Barre, yes. The body's own immune system begins to attack the nerves and destroys the myelin sheath. That produces very similar symptoms to arsenic poisoning. If you hadn't phoned us, it's not too far-fetched to believe that we might have come up with that diagnosis."
Patrick smiled. "Well, it's nice to get lucky sometimes." Then he turned serious again. "But, as I said, make sure that no one is allowed in his room. Then we'll do our job as best we can this afternoon." They shook hands, and Patrick went back out to the corridor. He thought for a moment that he glimpsed Charlotte in the distance. Then the door closed behind him. Göteborg, 1958. It was on a Tuesday when her life reached its absolute nadir. A cold, grey, foggy Tuesday in November that would be eternally imprinted in her memory. Although actually she didn't remember very many details. She mostly recalled that friends of her father came and told her that Mother had done something terrible, and that Mary would have to go with the lady from social welfare. She had seen in their faces that they felt qualms of conscience, that they couldn't take her home with them at least for a few days. But none of Father's snooty friends probably wanted to have such a disgustingly fat girl like herself in their homes. So in the absence of any relatives, she'd had to pack a bag with the bare necessities and go with the little old lady who came to collect her. The years that followed, she later remembered only in her dreams. Not really nightmares. She actually had no reason to complain about the three foster homes where she ended up until she turned 18. But they left her with an all-consuming feeling that she meant nothing to anyone, other than as a curiosity. For that was what a girl became if she was 14, obscenely fat, and the daughter of a murderess. Her various foster parents had neither the desire nor the energy to get to know the girl who had been assigned to them by social welfare. On the other hand, they had nothing against gossiping about her mother when their curiosity-seeking friends and acquaintances came to visit to gawk at Mary. She hated every last one of them. Most of all, she hated Mother. Hated her because she had abandoned her only daughter. Hated her because Mary had meant so little to her compared with a man. She was prepared to sacrifice everything for him, but nothing for her daughter. When she thought about what she'd sacrificed for Mother, the humiliation felt even greater. Mother had merely been using her, she saw that now. During her 14th year, she also understood what she should have realized long ago, that Mother had never loved her. She had tried to convince herself that what Mother said was true, that she did what she did because she loved Mary, the beatings, the cellar, and the spoonfuls of humility. But it wasn't true. Mother had enjoyed hurting Mary because she really despised her and laughed at her behind her back. That's why Mary had chosen to take only one thing with her from home. They had let her go around the flat for an hour to select a few things. The rest would be sold, just like the flat. She had wandered through the rooms as the memories passed through her mind. Father, in his easy chair, with his glasses on the tip of his nose, deeply engrossed in a newspaper. Mother at her dressing table, busy getting ready for a party. Herself sneaking down to the kitchen to try and find something to stuff in her mouth. All the images came over Mary as if in a crazy kaleidoscope, and she felt her stomach turn over. The next second she rushed to the toilet and vomited up a foul-smelling mess that brought tears to her eyes. Sniffling, she wiped off her mouth with the back of her hand, sat down with her back to the wall, and cried with her head between her knees. When she left the flat, she only took along a single thing, the blue wooden spoon, full of humility. No one had voiced any objections to Nicholas taking a day off. Ina had even muttered something to the effect that it was about time, and then cancelled all his appointments for the day. Nicholas crawled about on the floor chasing Albin, who was running around like mad among all the things scattered on the floor. He was still dressed in pyjamas, although it was past noon. But it didn't matter. It was going to be one of those days. Even Nicholas was still dressed in the same T-shirt and jogging trousers he'd slept in. Albin laughed heartily in a way Nicholas had never heard him do before, which made him crawl even faster after him and roughhouse even more. With a pang in his chest, he realised that he had no memory of himself playing with Sora the same way. He had always been so busy, so full of his own importance and everything he wanted to do and achieve. Feeling a little superior, he had left all that playing and fooling around with the kids to Charlotte, who did it so well. But for the first time, he wondered whether he wasn't the one who'd drawn the blank lot. Something suddenly occurred to him that made him stop short and take a quick breath. He didn't know what Sora's favourite game had been, or what kids' show she most liked to watch on TV, or if she liked colouring with a blue or red crayon, or what was her favourite subject in school, or which book she most liked for Charlotte to read to her at bedtime. He knew nothing of importance about his daughter. Absolutely nothing. She could just as well have been the neighbour's daughter, judging by how little he knew about her. The only thing he thought he'd known was that she was difficult, obstinate, and aggressive. That she hurt her little brother, destroyed things in their home, and attacked her schoolmates. But none of these things had been Sora. They were just things she did. The realisation made him curl up on the floor in torment. Now it was too late to get to know her. She was gone. Albin seemed to feel that something was wrong. He stopped his wild hooting, crept close to Nicholas, and curled up like a little animal against his body. Then they lay there, next to each other. Several minutes later, the doorbell rang. Nicholas gave a start, and Albin looked around nervously. "Don't worry," said Nicholas to him. "It's probably just some stranger selling something." He picked the boy up and went to the door. Outside stood Patrick with some unfamiliar men behind him.
"Oh, what is it now?" said Niklas wearily.
"We have a warrant to search the house," said Patrick, holding out a document as proof.
"But you've already been here once," said Niklas, bewildered, as he scanned the document. When he was halfway through, his eyes grew wide, and he gave Patrick a confused look.
"What the hell is this? Attempted murder of Stig Florin? You've got to be kidding!"
But Patrick wasn't laughing. "I'm afraid not. He's being treated right now for arsenic poisoning. He barely made it through the night."
"Arsenic poisoning?" said Niklas in surprise. "But how?"
He still couldn't grasp what was happening and didn't budge from the doorway. "That's what we intend to find out. So, if you would please let us come in." Without a word, Niklas stepped to one side. The men behind Patrick picked up their cases and equipment and came in with determined looks on their faces. Patrick stayed behind with Niklas in the hall and seemed to hesitate a moment before he said,
"We also have permission to exhume Lennart's grave. That work has probably already begun."
Niklas felt his mouth fall open. What was happening was just too unreal for him to grasp. "But why? What? I mean, who?" he stammered.
"We can't explain it all right now, but we have good reason to believe that he was poisoned with arsenic as well. Though he wasn't as lucky as Stig," Patrick added grimly. "But now I'd appreciate it if you could stay out of the way and let my men do their job."
Patrick didn't wait for his answer, but went into the house. Unsure of what to do next, Niklas went into the kitchen and sat down at the table, still holding Albin in his arms. He placed him in his high chair and bribed him with a biscuit to keep him quiet. Inside Niklas's mind, the questions were tumbling around. Martin was shivering in the biting wind. His uniform jacket provided little protection from the bitter winds blowing across the churchyard. Just after they arrived, it had begun to drizzle as well. The whole operation turned his stomach. He had only been to a few funerals, and to stand here and watch while a coffin was lifted out of the ground instead of down into it felt as wrong as watching a film running backwards. He understood why Patrick had asked him to take charge this time. Patrick had already been through this experience once, just a few months earlier, and once in a lifetime was surely enough. Confirming this notion, he thought he heard one of the gravediggers muttering,
"You guys must have been placing bets at the station to see how many old coots you could get us to dig up in the shortest possible time."
Martin didn't reply, thinking that it probably wasn't worth it to make any more requests of the prosecutor for a while. Torbjörn Ruud came over to stand next to him. He couldn't help making a comment either.
"Huh. I suppose they better start putting elastic bands on the coffins here in Fjällbacka. Then all you have to do is pull them up when you want them."
Martin couldn't resist a wry smile, despite the unsuitable occasion, and they were both fighting to keep from laughing when Torbjörn's mobile rang.
"Yes, this is Ruud."
He listened, then punched off and said to Martin,
"They're going into the Florin's house now. We've assigned 3 men there and 2 out here, so we'll see whether we have to regroup."
"What exactly do you need to do here, right now, I mean?" said Martin curiously.
There's not much we can do. Right now, we're just watching to make sure that everything is removed with as little contamination as possible. Then we'll take some soil samples too, but mostly it's a matter of taking the body to the ME so that he can start taking the samples he needs. As soon as the coffin has been sent off, we'll go over to the Florins and help out with the search. You're going too, I assume?"
Martin nodded. "Yes, I thought I would." He paused for a moment. "What a bloody mess this has turned out to be." Ruud nodded in turn.
"You can say that again."
The topics of conversation run dry. They stood in silence as they waited for the men at the gravesite to finish their work. A little while later, the lid of the coffin came into view. Lennart Klinger was above ground again. End of Disc 12.